Hi, and welcome to Fido, an audio adventure into fantasy, folklore, and fairy tales. I'm John, your host, and thanks for dropping in. This week, I've got another collaboration episode for you from the Pizza Rice Podcasting Collaborative. This time, it's with Abby and Alan over at the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast. Recently, I sat down and had a conversation with them on their show about the history of fairy tales. We're both releasing this episode in two parts, and I'll be releasing three fairy tales that I recorded for their show as episodes here. I had a great time with Abby and Alan, and I think a lot of valuable discussion was had. While I tend to keep most of my commentary relatively surface level, they dig thoroughly into things over at the Lunatics Radio Hour, and I think you'll find their exploration very interesting. A word of caution that this conversation digs into some heavy, potentially upsetting topics in places. I think it's all handled with care, but all the same, I just want you to know that it's there, so you can either choose to pass this one over or continue as an informed listener. I'll take you now over to my visit at the Lunatics Radio Hour for the disturbing history of fairy tales, part one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast. I'm Abby Branker. I'm here with Alan Kudan.
Hello.
And we are also here today with John Cook of the Fido podcast. Welcome, John.
Hi. Thank you guys very much for having me on.
Yeah, and I'm sure you guys have some familiarity with Fido just because of all of our cross promotions and social media back and forth. But John, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about Fido, because we're huge fans.
Well, thank you, first of all. I appreciate that. Fido is what I've basically come to sort of describe as a storytelling podcast with a bit of armchair commentary. And it was sort of born out of the need to reach out and connect during the lockdowns last year. It started in May of last year, so just came up on a year. Basically, every episode, I read a story, and then I'll, you know, give some commentary on it. And I've done everything at this point. I started with fairy tales exclusively, but I've done, you know, I've done some science fiction, some pulps from the 40s. I've done some of my own work. And it's really grown beyond just fairy tales, but it's mainly that. And it's just a lot of fun. I think I have a good time over there, and I hope that everyone listening does as well. So, yeah, that's Fido in a nutshell.
It's a very good spread of stories.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, I've tried to branch out. Like, I started, like I said, with just one or two types, but I found that I'm really enjoying reading some of the, you know, some of the different style. You know, the pulp science fiction is so much fun because, you know, back in the, I don't know, in the 40s and such when it was being written, we didn't know as much about space and they were just filling in the blanks and having a great time with it. And it was so much fun.
Isn't that great, though, when they fill in the blanks and accidentally get it right?
I know. Yeah. And okay, so this conversation comes up, too. Well, it has with you and Bob and me and Bob. Bob Dawn from Bob's Short Story Hour.
Big fans of Bob Dawn.
Yeah.
Yes, we're big fans of Bob Dawn. But the idea that science fiction, particularly out of that rocket ship era, has really influenced our science and our technology, like the tablets and flip phones and things that came out of Star Trek almost directly. And so it's fun to see how it's influenced us.
Yeah, for sure. I also really love, I think some of the earliest episodes that I listened to of Fido when I first was introduced to you was the Edgar Allan Poe cover. You know, and you do such a good job. I've said this before on the podcast, but you really do, you and Bob both, like, make some of these like older stories that are dense and written in language that might not always be accessible. It makes it really come to life and so easy to consume it. So yeah, Fido is awesome. Everyone go check out Fido. And I think it's a perfect introduction really to what we're talking about today, which is fairy tales.
Fairy tales.
Yes. So today we're going to talk about, with John, the history of fairy tales. And we're also going to do, of course, a really fun story episode after this, filled with all kinds of fairy tales. We have a modern fairy tale submission, and we have tons of examples of more classics. So it's going to be really fun. I am going to say at the head of this right now, you know, we're not going to get super graphic in this episode, but the kind of overlap between fairy tales and horror, which is what we do, is very, is kind of the disturbing origin of them, right? And we look back at like the Disney versions, which is probably what most people are familiar with to some extent, and it's nothing at all like the original and how brutal some of those are. So we're going to talk about some things that are a little rough. We're not going to go into any like harmful details around it, but just so that everyone knows, there's going to be, you know, some mentions here and there throughout of tougher topics. So today's sources, we have, of course, as always, our great friend Wikipedia, which, by the way, is a great resource if you're looking for some of the original summaries of some of these old fairy tales. They have pretty robust coverage of it on Wikipedia.
Have you done your yearly contribution to Wikipedia yet?
Of course.
Good.
Every time.
Yes, yes. We, part of our Patreon proceeds go right into Wikipedia. We owe them our lives. A BBC article, Where Do Fairy Tales Come From? A TED Talk by Anne Duggan. A study from Royal Society Open Science. The 10 Darkest and Most Disturbing Fairy Tales on culturetrip.com. A Flavor Wire article by Emily Temple. The 10 Most Odd and Creepy Hans Christian Andersen Fairy Tales from themost10.com. And a book called The Hard Facts of the Grimm Fairy Tales, by Maria Tatar. Without further ado, let's jump into defining fairy tales. Most people are probably familiar with what a fairy tale is, but let's try to define it despite that.
Thank you.
Fairy tales are typically short stories that include magical elements or mythical creatures. For example, witches, mermaids, dragons, dwarves. Fairy tales can either be written or passed down through generations orally. In most cases, they're both.
Fairy tales may also include fairies.
Yes. Yes.
You missed that one? Really?
I
don't think it was in the list, but that's okay. Because it's kind of there in the title.
It's an important point, though.
Yes, I stand corrected. Yes, of course. Fairy tales do often include fairies. Yes, yes.
But no, I think that's a pretty fair definition. You know, I've always kind of extended it to, you know, tales of the unknown. There's one that I did, Why the Sea is Salt. That is, it's sort of, some of them that sort of explain the unknown origins of the things that we see in the world. You know, why the sea is salty. And that's another sort of, I think, facet to it. It sort of fills it, like we were saying on the sci-fi, it sort of fills in the gaps, you know?
Yeah, sort of like Greek mythology, you know, like they have gods of thunder to understand why thunder, you know, that's obviously a simplified example, but.
And so, I guess, I mean, that's more of a folkloric sort of thing. It's not necessarily a fairy tale, but it's part of the whole picture.
Well, that's my question. Like, where do you draw the line between fairy tale, folk tale, and mythology?
There are lots of like overlap types of stories, right? So we also have legends and fables, and those center around a moral agenda, but in some cases are considered different, like, you know, there are different like subcategories which can overlap with fairy tales, but are kind of like a different categorization. And a lot of what we're going to talk about today, honestly, is like folk tales and fairy tales. You know, it's kind of hard. It would be very nuanced for us to only talk specifically about fairy tales, which would include like magical elements. But there's usually, they kind of go hand in hand with each other.
Yeah, I think they blend profusely.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's also differences between original folk tales and literary folk tales. In many cases, the fairy tales we know were taken from local folklore and turned into works by authors, which is going to be a big part of what we talk about today. Fairy tales often reflect the culture at the time, meaning the lessons within them show us how people thought about their values, about good, evil, and punishment. You can, for example, track one fairy tale throughout like different versions of it that are published or even before. And you can see like how the moral at the end changes to reflect what's the current kind of focus or need of society to address, which is very interesting.
Very, very academic.
Yes, it's a very academic, serious episode. Yes. Yeah. One of the most fascinating things I learned in this research is that while there are a few dominant collections, one, of course, being the Brothers Grimm and the other Charles Perrault's Tales of the Olden Times from 1697, there is also so much more to fairy tale history. Stories that pass down within different regions across the globe. We've heard of Hans Christian Andersen's Danish stories and Walter Scott from Scotland. but fairy tales exist across all geographies and peoples. And I will say, we touch a little in this episode on a few examples of Asian fairy tales, but it really is like European focused. But again, you could do a whole episode on fairy tales from every single region of the world, because this tradition really is kind of like a universal thing that we've seen across history, which is really cool. Wilhelm Grimm of the Brothers Grimm believed that some of the fairy tales they transcribed were thousands of years old and actually can be used as a marker of the beginning of Indo-European language. But some folklore scholars had a different view, claiming that fairy tales were based in more recent history, until a study was published on Royal Society Open Science. The paper was written by Sarah Garza de Silver and Jamshid J. Tarani. The researchers looked at the correlation between these stories with population linguistic patterns, variants, and geography. They compared the tales of magic, set from the biggest compendium of fairy tales called the Arne-Thompson-Uther Index, and were able to trace at least 76 of the 275 stories back to the invention of English, French, or Italian languages.
Can we start getting into the more, you know, nuanced facts, please? This is stuff everyone knows.
This is the only dense part, and then it gets more fun, I promise.
I mean, you had me at Yarn Uther.
Well, you know, no, this to me, this fascinates me to know it, because this is the same stuff I came across when I started my show, mm-hmm. is the idea that the fairy tales are almost like they traveled across the world like a language, like, and you can see the language in it and you can see them travel. It's fascinating to me.
We're talking about how they travel all around the world.
Yes.
Yet most fairy tales seem very, very Eurocentric.
Well, those are the ones you're familiar with.
They are.
Yeah. And I will say, like, we'll talk about this later, but Cinderella, for example, there's 60, whatever. No, that's a made up number, but there's a lot of known versions of Cinderella across the globe. So we're going to tell the Chinese version of that, the South American version of that.
Well, okay. So that was the follow up question.
Yeah.
Do they just become, you know, appropriated by the cultures as they?
Yes, for sure.
Well, and I think, I think the important thing there is, you know, I personally have a European background. And mm-hmm. so the European culture takes the bones of the story and they make it their own to resonate inside their own cultures. And I think that happens to all the cultures.
Sure.
A lot of, you know, and it's fascinating to see. And in some ways, it's a great way to learn about different cultures, is to see their version of the story and what sticks out and what's important to them.
Some of these go back like 6,000 years. And so that's before we have territories and cultures as we see them now, right? These are very, very old stories. And so some of these in the tradition of fairy tales and folk stories predates, right, like country lines and geographies in the way we think of them in 2021. And to see, you know what I mean? And so it's very fascinating to see how enduring some of these are. Jack and the Beanstalk is actually over 5,000 years old, for example.
How do we know that?
Because I read it on YouTube. This is also known as a series of iterations from The Boy Who Stole the Ogre's Treasure. Versions of Jack and the Beanstalk are categorized as a type of story called The Boy Who Stole the Ogre's Treasure, right? That's kind of like the overall.
Yeah, they really just give away the whole plot in the title.
Beauty and the Beast and Rumpelstiltskin were first published in the 17th century, published in a book, but as you may guess, can actually be traced back to origins from between 2,500 and 6,000 years ago. And I'm sure you're wondering, Alan, what is the oldest fairy tale that's actually been identified?
I mean, we all know this, but please go ahead.
I can see him wondering right here. I can see him wondering.
A story that is at least 6,000 years old, if not older, originated in the Bronze Age, called The Smith and the Devil.
Oh.
That this predates even the earliest version of Indo-European language. I was not familiar with this story, but I'll give you the summary.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's that one about?
So a blacksmith or a metal worker of some kind sells their soul to an evil demon. In return, they get the ability to weld together any and all materials, right? So they become like a master welder. The blacksmith tricks the devil and tries to leash him to a huge boulder to get out of the pact.
Oh, the good old Prometheus trick.
Mm-hmm. And he is successful.
Oh.
So it's interesting, right? Like that story is 6,000, is confirmed to be at least 6,000 years old. Like Jack and the Beanstalk confirmed to be at least 5,000 years old. Like how do you even wrap your head around that, you know?
And what I love, and so the Smith and the Devil, that particular story is one that I have yet to do on the show, but it's one that I want to do on the show, because it's one of those that I think nobody has heard of, but everybody knows. And of course, I tend to filter my commentary through a heavy lens of pop culture and things of that nature. I try to, you know, I don't get too scholarly or academic, but mostly it's observational and things of that nature. But The Devil Went Down to Georgia.
Yeah.
What is that? 70s, 1970s, the Charlie Daniels song.
Yeah.
But we still have that story, and it shows up in many ways, you know, tricking the devil out of, you know, his whatever. And The Devil Went Down to Georgia is one of my favorite iterations of The Smith and the Devil. It's just, you're not, you know, now he's a skilled fiddle player, not a skilled blacksmith.
Wow. That's a great connection. I didn't even think about that. I love that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, tricking the devil is an old, old, old story. And that goes way back, way back.
We watched a movie fairly recently. It sounds so familiar. And I couldn't remember the exact title, so I had to Google it, which was Aramentari. The English release of that movie was called The Devil and the Blacksmith.
We watched that?
We did. It was like a year ago.
I don't think I was there for that. That's interesting. What country was it made in?
Oh, it was in Spain.
Got it. Interesting. Very interesting.
And it's similar to the plot of the fairy tale of a blacksmith does a pact with the devil to get something. He achieves his goal, I suppose, but then he becomes ostracized by society. He's being like marked by the devil, but that's because the devil is just like always around, like trying to fuck with him. Mm-hmm. And so he locks up the devil, and then things even get worse because like he has the devil locked up, and then all the devil's little minions are hanging around causing havoc.
What is interesting to me about this is that's like, sounds like a one-to-one modern remake, you know? And so like, even though we weren't super aware of this story, still, and you know, someone in Spain was, and they remade, like, they named it the same thing and remade it
in 2017.
Yeah, that's crazy.
There's another story that's related, and I think it might be Middle Eastern. It might even be, don't quote me on this, it might be in the Arabian Nights, I'm not sure. But there's another one, the genie and the fisherman, where essentially he finds a genie bottle in a lake and tricks the genie, you know, obviously wants to give him three wishes, but the wishes don't go as planned. But he ends up tricking the genie back into the bottle by appealing to his vanity or something like that. I don't have
got him.
Yeah, you know, and so it's one of those things where like that whole story is everywhere. It's in a lot of different cultures, and being that old, it ought to be, I would think.
It's just so impressive that it has lasted, you know, that it is just not lost, knowing that it, for the majority of its life, if so to speak, it was passed down orally.
Yeah. And how many things are not lost that we don't even know are not lost,
right?
Because we don't know they were ever, or, you know, that we don't know their origins. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
I know.
Yeah, it's true.
So we cannot talk about the history of fairy tales without talking about the Brothers Grimm. You've probably heard of the Brothers Grimm. Wilhelm Carl Grimm, and Carl spelt with a C, was born in what is now Germany in 1786, and his brother Jacob Ludwig Carl Grimm, Carl with a K, was born in 1785. I just love that the two brothers both have the middle name of Carl, but one is spelt with a C and one is spelt with a K.
Yeah, for their fathers.
The brothers were many things, including academics, German language scholars, researchers, and philosophers. However, they are most well known for collecting and publishing folklore in the 19th century. The Romantic movement at the time had inspired a renewed interest in folktales. The Brothers Grimm and other scholars at the time looked to these folktales as a way to really understand the culture that created them. You'll likely recognize some of the stories they republished: Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Little Red Riding Hood, Snow White, Rapunzel, Hansel and Gretel, Rumpelstiltskin, and the Frog Prince, just to name a few. They published their classic collection within two volumes, in 1812 and 1815. The first editions included just over 150 stories. The seventh and last grew to 200 stories.
That's a lot of stories.
A lot of stories.
Very many stories.
The tales that the Grimms collected and immortalized have seen many different uses, everything from adaptations by Walt Disney to propaganda used by the Third Reich. Because some of the original releases were seen as quote-unquote unappealing to children, the brothers eventually re-edited and sanitized later versions in an attempt to reach a broader audience, which we're going to talk about more in a second.
Hold on. Tell me more about these Nazi fairy tales.
I anticipated this question from you.
As you should.
So I looked into it a little bit. And there was certain fairy tales that they sort of forced people, and I don't, again, know a lot of the background information, but that they like kind of made required reading. And yeah, I don't know what the morals of those stories were, but I'm guessing they were in line with what the Nazi party thought was important.
Got it.
I think what's interesting about them, and I only know a little bit about this from, but the Nazis both forced certain tales in their own way, but then they outlawed much of the folklore and folk music that was actually alive in Germany at the time. Hmm. So it was more of a controlled focus than it was an outright elimination. And it's that sort of control that we've come to know from them. But the folklore and folk music really saw a resurgence because of its, you know, it's outlawing by the Third Reich, which was, it backfired on them.
Right. Yeah. It's like Footloose, right? You tell the kids. Kind of,
exactly. It's exactly like Footloose.
Then,
yeah. I mean, okay. It's not exactly like Footloose, but you get what I mean.
Yes, I do. I do get what you mean.
I'd watch that version of Footloose.
Wow.
Oh boy. By the 1870s, some of the stories had been adopted into school curriculums in Prussia. In the 20th century, the only printed book more popular was the Bible in Germany than the Brothers Grimm's collection. The book The Hard Facts About the Grimm's Fairy Tales by Maria Tatar focuses on the evolution of their versions of these works. She calls out, for example, that we talked about how the Brothers Grimm sort of sanitized some of their later editions, right? Because they wanted to reach a broader audience. She kind of dives into this from a modern perspective and studies that it's even harder for the Brothers Grimm to tolerate pregnancy than it is for them to tolerate violence. So as they edited the stories to make them more acceptable for society, quote unquote, they removed what they called certain conditions and relationships. In the first edition, the story of Hans Dumm is included. This character has the power to impregnate women simply by wishing it to be so. By the second edition of the Nursery and Household Tales, the story is totally removed. Similarly, the Grimms got hold of the story, The Master Hunter, in an earlier form by Dorothea Weinmann. The hunter finds a naked princess asleep, lays down with her, and later she discovers she's pregnant. In this actual kind of like little plot moment, we see in a ton of fairy tales as we go through. In the Grimm version, the hunter acts as a model of restraint, right? So in the original, the hunter comes through, he sees a naked woman, he lays down with her. In the Grimm version, they totally change this. So he comes in, he sees her, and he's like, oh, I'm going to pass on this, right? Like, I am nothing if not a gentleman. So they kind of change the plot to make it what they think is more acceptable, right? They remove this act.
I mean, I think that's a reasonable change.
No, yeah, I'm not judging them. I'm just calling out some of the changes that they made. You can see these changes explicitly when you look at the Grimm's drafts. For example, in The Frog King, we see parts of the story change from the draft stage to publication, explicitly removing talk of pregnancy. The Brothers Grimm also removed another common theme that we see in early versions of these tales, which is incest. In certain stories where removing these themes would completely change the meaning of the tale, Wilhelm Grimm would instead include judgmental language. So in Thousand Furs, the father proposes marriage to his daughters throughout, like over and over again. It's kind of like the plot of the story.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the second edition of the Grimm version, his court counsel strongly reprimands him. And in later editions, the father's actions lead to even more dramatic punishments, quoting, that the entire kingdom be dragged down to perdition. What's kind of fascinating about the origins of these stories?
Mm-hmm.
Is that they've become these like beloved children's tales that Disney has made super popular and other, you know, even like you have a fairy tale storybook, right? That is geared towards children. But when you look back at the origins of them.
Geared towards children, but it's on like the cusp of when things are sort of changing.
Right. But when you look back at really the origins of them, they're violent. They include sexual assault in a lot of cases. There's pregnancy before marriage in a lot of cases. There's all of these things that are shocking when you look at kind of the origins of Sleeping Beauty, which, again, we'll kind of get into some more specifics. But this kind of moment in this podcast right now is to look at the Grimms specifically, because they're widely, like, when you think about fairy tales, most people, even if you don't know the history of them, you know about the Brothers Grimm, right? They made a lot of these tales incredibly popular because they published them and immortalized them. And it's fascinating to look at, like, their first editions and the things that they thought were okay to keep in, which was kind of because they were doing it originally for academic purposes. And then as they started to make money with it, and they were like, oh, we could reach more people if these were a little more PG, they dial back certain elements. And the thing that I'm kind of trying to dial in on a little is that they don't necessarily dial back the violence, but what they choose to, which I think is us also, like, looking at them and their culture right now and what they, you know, what was acceptable and not acceptable to them, which is what they were doing with the fairy tales. But, like, they choose to not include conversations about incest, which, like, yeah, sure, I'm on board with that. Conversations about plot points about pregnancy, but they keep in some, like, pretty violent things. So it's just interesting to think about, like, what was going on in their society that kind of prompted this removal of certain elements. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think you hit on the thing. They started as an academic documentation, and you're right. When they started to realize that this was going to be a business, this was going to be a livelihood, they shifted to what society wanted to read, not what history had brought them. And so I think it's a good indication of what the society at the time was interested in consuming in entertainment and things of that nature. But I think we still do the same thing. I don't think that we've come too far, because that's a terrible way to say it. I think we've come plenty far, but I think that there are still certain things that we want to read and don't want to read, and violence is still very popular.
Is anyone familiar with a collection of fairy tales that's kind of like taking it back more towards the source material? Like, I know there was, like, the whole Grimm TV show that I never saw, but I'm assuming was not made for kids.
I watched some of it. I don't know if you did, Abby, but they borrowed from that original, some of the original flavor. Mm-hmm. They didn't make it too accurate.
when they found the woman laying in the woods, they still
I don't know if that ever happened in the Grimm TV show, but I haven't seen the whole thing, but from what I watched, it was kind of a fun adaptation where the Grimms were not simply collectors of fairy tales; they were hunters of magical beasts and so forth.
Hell yeah!
And it's kind of an inherited job, you know, that lands on this guy. But they did,
like,
borrow a lot
premise.
Of the lore. Yeah, it is a great premise. Yeah, but they borrowed a lot from the lore, but they didn't really they didn't get too gritty.
Yeah.
Well, which also feels very much in line with just how folk tales are generally told. When you think of fairy tales, you don't think so much embellishment as you think of with folklore, because it's usually like a written down, established something.
Well, and that would be the literary version. But
yes, thank you.
I absolutely believe that the stories that the Grimms collected were one version of the story that the Grimms collected. One of the things that I think is lost when the Grimms did a great service to preserving the actual stories. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have the knowledge of some of these things if they hadn't written them down. But you lose something in the writing down of the story as opposed to the telling of the story.
Sure.
And that's the dynamic between the teller and the listener.
Yeah.
And the story would have evolved from telling to telling based on who was sitting around your fire. It would have changed based on what person's values wanted to come across and what story. It was mutable and malleable until it was written down, and then we lost the dynamic. So we're looking at it from that perspective, but it's all on paper at this point, so it never changes until it does and someone writes it down differently. But
yeah, or until they make the HBO version.
The HBO version, and then we get back to the basics. We get back to that whole
Yeah, exactly. I will say, Alan, because I think originally you were asking about, like, is there a collection of the originals?
Or not the originals, but just, like, made for adults again.
I think a lot of these collections right now that we're talking about, like Perrault's collections, the Grimm collections, weren't necessarily made for children. Like, they weren't being sanitized at this point because of kids.
Right.
Like, Perrault was writing them down for, like, French high society. They were being marketed towards adults, but society was at whatever level of comfortability they were with some of the topics, right? And so that is coming through. And then later they become like a children's focus when we get to Disney and more modern versions. But I will say, if you or anyone else is interested in reading some of the earlier unsanitized versions, they're all very accessible online. Like, you can find them. There's tons of there's websites for Hans Christian Andersen's collections. You could also find them on Project Gutenberg. You can also find them on Wikipedia. And some, you know, the originals or like early versions are very accessible online. So mm-hmm. if there's any as we go through that we don't go into as much as you would like to learn about, you can very easily Google it and read like a bunch of different versions. And most of them are pretty short, to be honest.
Cool.
The interesting thing is they started as in an effort to, I think, study and preserve German folklore specifically. So also part of this is what they preserved and what has become really popular are the German versions of these, right? And they already existed orally in tons of other areas, which would have had, to your point, totally different versions of them. But because they were the people who chose to do it, right? That's kind of like those have become written on the tablet, so to speak. And then again, as these became more broadly appealing and kind of people wanted mass produced versions, they got kind of whitewashed, so to speak, a little bit until they became like a more palatable version of what they originally were.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm going to say it anyways.
Okay.
When I was in college and taking, you might know this because you went to college.
Yeah.
For English.
Yeah.
When I was there, when I took my first writing class, the professor was giving so much credit to the Brothers Grimm mm-hmm. For establishing a lot of things, like for literary structure, coining the three act structure, the rules of threes, protagonist, antagonist, inciting incident, and how this was all these things existed previously, but they just really baked it down to a formula when they wrote it down.
Interesting. I had never heard that before. Had you, John?
Not specific to the Brothers Grimm, but for fairy tales and things in general, I've heard things like that before, but I don't know how true it is either. I'm with you, but at least in my observation, that's they certainly did well with that. I don't know if they're the first ones to do it. I couldn't tell you.
I mean, highly doubt that they're the first ones to do
it. Right? Yeah, and it may be that they're the first ones to really codify it in that that succinctly. But I don't even know that. I couldn't venture to guess.
Well, you might have identified it earlier when you're saying how their book was second only in popularity to the Bible.
Yeah.
So it is, that's fair. Yeah.
So if everyone is familiar with it, of course they're going to get the credit for it.
Yeah. I mean, that was in Germany, but yeah.
Yeah. And certainly the credit for popularizing it in Germany. I mean, that's exactly, you know.
So here comes what I think is the fun part of this. Let's look at a few specific fairy tales and track some of the changes. John actually did an episode on Fedot about Little Red Riding Hood, which is where we're going to start. So go listen to that as well, because he has beautiful readings of the versions of both that we're going to talk about. And I think it's an awesome companion to this little section here. So Little Red Riding Hood, though this tale is often attributed to Charles Perrault, who was the first person to officially write and publish it, but it actually is over 2,000 years old. It's believed to have originated between Europe and the Middle East. The Perrault version was published in the 17th century. There is also a Grimm version of the story. And it originated along with its author, Perrault, in France. So like I said earlier, it was written for an audience of Perrault's peers, meaning the French aristocrats and societal elites. Perrault was actually a prominent figure in France during the reign of Louis XIV, not just because of his fairy tales. He also held positions in government.
Not just because of his fairy tales?
That's right.
I find that hard to believe.
So I meant to say, like, he was a society man. He was involved in the government. He was well off. He kind of had a little group of elite people that like to hang out at his house and hear him tell fairy tales. But it's also interesting that like he was like a creative and he was also like a government official. You know, it's kind of like an interesting position to have.
Let's hope that's how he was announced every time he went into a room. Fairy tale and society man.
Perrault would have written this version of Little Red Riding Hood to be told to his impressive and wealthy group of friends. He was writing fairy tales not for children at all at this point. The part of this fairy tale you may be less familiar with is the moral that Perrault includes at the very end. So I'm going to assume everybody is mostly familiar with the story of Little Red Riding Hood. So this fairy tale actually brings us full circle and allows us to understand the story in the context it was originally written for. Prose moral. We see here that young children, and this is quoting, sorry. We see here that young children, especially young, well-bred ladies, should not listen to any sort of person. It isn't strange that a wolf eats so many of them up. I say wolf, for not all wolves are the same kind. Some are of a comely humor, who follow young ladies into their homes, into their salons, but alas, who does not know that these smooth-talking wolves are the most dangerous wolves of all? In Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf tricks her, dresses up as the grandmother, gets her into the grandmother's house. Perrault's version, he's explicitly admitting, and I do like that in Perrault, all of Perrault's versions of fairy tales, he includes like a moral that's like called out separately at the end.
Just in case you miss it in the subtext. Just
exactly, yeah. He's like, hey, he's admitting, right, that this version is meant to be a warning to women specifically at this time to avoid smooth talking wolfish men, right, who are going to try to get them home. This bit gets dropped in most retellings, but you can see that it gives us context. Perrault is talking about smooth talking wolfish men who follow women uninvited into their homes. So he's talking about sexual assault and rape. We also see this echoed in the violence throughout the story. And I will note that some scholars still believe that this tale is about seduction, but I think given the nature of the story, there's also a good case to be made about it being a more violent allegory. The other theme here that rings true to society is that Red Riding Hood is almost blamed or given some responsibility for what is happening to her. In more modern versions, we often see her sexualized, especially Tex Avery's animation Red Hot Riding Hood from 1943. Yeah. So there's a ton of versions of, I mean, even till this day, right, there's so many recent live action movies of Red Riding Hood, and you often see her as
a sexy Halloween costume.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, you know what I think that kind of relates to? We talked about taboo subjects and things that we don't like to talk about in society, and the things that they didn't like to talk about in society. I think nowadays, in order to make this tale palatable, we grow her up and make her a kind of sexual being, so that we're not bothered by the fact that she's a little girl,
right?
So we give her what society sees as a good deal of power so that she can face the wolf on modern society's terms.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. So, but yeah. And even like once upon a time, they made her this sexy diner worker. Like, I don't know if you've seen Once Upon a Time. Like,
yeah.
She's like, I don't know. She likes, I can't even remember. She likes motorcycles and it's like, you know, but they give her. Yeah, right. Yeah, but I think that's what we've done. Like we've done that so that we can handle the fact that Riding Hood has to deal with all of these things. Mm-hmm. And if she's a little girl, we can't handle that.
We're remaking the story in modern terms, and the solution is to make her just like someone who could handle it, you know, versus changing the nature of, you know, versus like putting blame, like we're just making her stronger so she can fight for her, you know.
What would you prefer, like if you were retelling Red Riding Hood, how would you retell it? I'm curious, I'd just love to know.
This brings me back to our conversations we've had many times on this podcast about She-Wolf.
Yeah, which, I'm hoping we'll go there.
Yeah, which is if somehow anyone doesn't know, it's a silly script that I wrote in the first Lunatics film that we made. And also we have an episode where there's a different version of it that I wrote. And essentially it's a short story or short film that I wrote. And the idea is that there's a woman who is a werewolf and she only preys on men who are trying to assault her or hurt her in some way. I've done the same thing essentially, right? Like, okay, but what we're saying is that
you've done the same thing.
No, I'm just saying I've done the same thing that I'm telling John I wished that, you know, Once Upon a Time didn't do, which is that like the response is, oh, women need to be a certain way in order to survive men, in order to handle men, in order to not be assaulted by men. Like women need to be violent and prepared to fight to the death in order to, which is like, okay, maybe true. But like, also, don't you wish that the story we were saying wasn't, okay, women, you need to be really strong. And not just women, but I'm just talking about this example specifically, right? Women, you need to be super strong to defend yourself versus the moral of the story being men don't rape women.
Yeah, I think more specifically what you did with She-Wolf. And I watched She-Wolf. I went after you guys talked about it. I was like, well, I got to see this. First of all, the nails, the manicure.
Yeah.
So good. Second of all, I think what She-Wolf does is actually flip the script a little bit and turns the wolf into the woman.
Yeah.
And so the man becomes Red Riding Hood in that story. Which is interesting, and I'm here for it. It was super fun.
Thank you.
It was cool. But I think that the only way out of that story, the only way out of Red Riding Hood, is where the wolf is not so wolfy and the girl is not so clueless. If you're going to tell a story that talks about, you know, healthy relationships between the wolf and the girl, then you've got to have, you know, a less wolfy wolf and a less whatever Red is. I don't know.
Yeah.
They need to meet in the middle somewhere, in my opinion. And that's, you know, if I was going to tell a different story, that's what I would do. But no, I think you're right. I think, you know, it's easy. It's an easy way out to just say, well, clearly they can handle it. So right. Let's just make them, you know, and I think that gets in your face. Like, nobody wants to be, you know, assaulted with that, but
femininity and masculinity is very fluid, but that, like, women almost need to be masculine, you know, women need to be men almost in order to, you know what I mean?
I've never been one to agree with that particular thing. Like, you've got to be this way to solve the problem. And I think that's the wrong way to go.
Yeah. It's actually interesting, though, because there is a later early version of Red Riding Hood that does not flip the script as dramatically as we're talking about, but does a little bit, which we'll talk about.
You really have to, like, take a step back and, like, what is the moral lesson that is being discussed in the story? Most people, in order to learn a moral lesson, you have to identify with the protagonist, usually see their journey in some facet. And so if you're trying to teach a lesson about making the wolf less wolfy, then the story would almost have to be from their perspective. You would have to see their emotional journey or turmoil, right?
More of a Frankenstein's monster sort of scenario than anything.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
But instead, the lesson is that there's always going to be predators.
Right, which is true.
And
in the best of cases, somebody's still going to be a problem.
Yeah. So, and you have to be able to identify the predator before it causes danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to blame any victims. But I would love it if the victims were prepared.
And I'll also play devil's advocate, and I love the trope of, you have the very stereotypical victim who is in a lot of trouble, and then you just arm them with, you know, high powered weaponry or something, and, like, that's act two of the film.
Yeah. And for me, like, I agree with you. I like a vulnerable protagonist, because I love an underdog.
Mm-hmm.
But I also love an underdog who discovers that they have the skills or the tools to solve the problem, whatever it is. And it doesn't have to be Lord Riding Hood. But any of those scenarios, I love an underdog story, but I hate it when they give me an underdog and promise they're going to win and then they don't. I hate that. Don't do that to me.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you both. I think, to me, even looking outside of the story of Little Red Riding Hood, right? Looking at Perrault's specific moral that he called out, that to me is, like, his specific moral was women beware of, like, young girls beware of wolfish men. What if his specific moral, and again, like, I'm not going to rewrite history, but what if his specific moral was men don't assault and stalk women? To me, that's the key, right? The
moral itself is
the key, right?
That's an excellent point. And who's to say that that wasn't out there, but it just didn't get written down? Mm-hmm. I hope so. I hope it was. But I think that's a great point. We should definitely be addressing both sides of that coin. The young innocent girl in the court definitely needs to know what's already there. But we also need to take some sort of step on the other side of the coin.
As a side note.
Oh, boy.
So we were discussing how you have the story of a wolf being, like, super creepy and luring someone into their home for nefarious reasons, right?
Sort of,
but it reminds me of the movie Creep.
Oh my goodness.
When the guy puts on a wolf mask.
Yeah.
what was this? Snuffles, Buttercups,
or Peach Fuzz?
Peach Fuzz. That's what. He calls himself Peach Fuzz when he wears the wolf mask, and he lures them in with this false sense of security before conducting his nefarious plot.
John, have you seen Creep?
No, that sounds terrible.
So here, let me tell you about Creep. We're big fans of Creep and Creep 2 over here at Lunatics Radio. Creep is a Mark Duplass film, which he made with his brother. And it's fascinating from like a filmmaking perspective, because Mark Duplass is like a really famous actor. He's in like, you know, you might not know his name, but if you saw him, you'd be like, ah, that guy. And as like a side fun project with his brother, they made this film Creep, which
for like $30.
For like $30, which they had like no script. They kind of had an outline, and they used, it's kind of like a found footage film, and it, you know, but it does it really well, and they, it works really well. It's a horror film. It's scary, I'll say.
I hadn't guessed.
Yeah. And then arguably, I would say Creep 2 is even better. They're both on Netflix, I believe. But I think,
well, the sequel's always better, right?
Yeah, always in a horror movie. They're interesting because not only are they found footage horror films that are good, which is a genre of horror film that I really like, and they're actually effectively scary, more so the first one. The second one's a comedy, I would say. But I think, Alan, you're making a good point. And we even were watching, like,
I always do,
like Scooby-Doo this morning. And we're like, hey, or Looney Tunes. We're like, hey, the plot of this is just like the plot of Hansel and Gretel. And to see like kind of the basics of storytelling structure, and they say, right, there's only like six stories you can tell. But the basics of some of these plot points, you know, are still just being retold and recycled over and over and over again forever. You know, you're not really telling an original story. You're telling the part about storytelling that's so fun is the thing that you bring to that story as the writer, you know.
Absolutely.
The punchline is that my therapist made me watch it. So what does that say? I don't know.
And she knows, of course, you're into this whole thing, oh, yeah, like up to your elbows. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a later version of Little Red Riding Hood called The Story of Grandmother, which was taken from local peasant folklore in the 19th century and transcribed by Paul Delarue over 100 years after the Perrault version. A major call out is that this version includes cannibalism.
Oh, what a twist.
The little girl's mother sends her to bring milk and bread to her grandmother. She encounters the wolf, who asks her which path she's taking. He then beats her to her grandmother's house and kills the grandmother. But in this case, he chops up her body and puts some of her blood into a bottle. When Riding Hood arrives, he offers her some of the meat and blood to drink and eat, which he disguises as bread and wine.
Oh,
sure.
Classic move.
The wolf then asks her to take off her clothes, burn them in the fire, and get in bed with him. She does so and remarks on how hairy her grandmother feels. Before he has a chance to strike, however, she has to use the restroom. So the wolf ties rope around her ankle and sends her outside. And she escapes. She actually outwits him and escapes. The call out with this version, beyond the shockingly brutal cannibalism, are the connections we see to the wine being blood and the bread being the body. Because this version originated in the Catholic countryside of France, many believe this is symbolic of the Eucharist.
You don't say.
In Catholicism, it's believed that this ritual brings about strength. And some scholars believe that because Riding Hood ingests her grandmother, she is given the strength to escape from the wolf. Like, she's literally taking on the grandmother's wisdom and strength by eating part of her body. But look how different the meaning behind this tale is than Perrault's version. The story leaves us with an empowered woman who learns how to outwit a predator and survives.
I'm not sure that grandmother's wisdom did her any good.
No, it wasn't enough for grandmother to survive, but it was
maybe
enough
for
Riding
Hood. Combined wisdom of grandmother and Red.
Yeah.
And why did she have to get naked and burn her clothes?
I think because she was cold, or, you know, whatever. There was like a, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if the one that I read, it had parts of this in it, I think, but not all of it. I decided on my episode to do two of the five or six that I, and I don't remember exactly which two it was, but yeah, I remember this version, and I'm like, I clearly am missing something culturally.
Yeah.
That I don't have all of the cultural context to understand this one fully. I remember thinking that, and like, yeah, but I did. I picked up on the whole bread and wine thing as well. I wondered how Red could be so clueless. She clearly doesn't know what wine tastes like.
And what bread? Bread versus bloody meat, you know?
Seriously. And so, but I'm sure there's some cultural context there that I don't have that probably made that resonate with whoever heard it or told it to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just conjecture, but I think if you live, you're sort of like in a peasant society and it's cold and you're in the woods and you come home and like you all huddle in one bed, you know, to me, I'm like, there could be some sort of warmth thing happening there, but the burning the clothes, I'm not, well, I did not trace that.
You know, gathering in one bed is certainly nothing that's not weird to me. The burning the clothes, I'm not sure why we're burning the clothes.
Yeah, but I can naked even, with your grandmother, I think Freud would have a lot to say about that.
Well,
one.
And the thing is, it may not even be that, like burning your clothes may be the over, she may have an undershirt, like a right. slip, a night clothes or something, or a slip underneath. We don't know. But I've thought through that. I was like, that's really strange to burn your clothes. Maybe, maybe for fleas. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, a wolf that was foreshadowing.
Yeah,
a wolf
exactly.
would be very exactly. Anti-flea.
Anti-flea, yeah. Super anti-flea.
Which is when I think of like old brutal riddle Little Red Riding Hood, I think of the one where the woodcutter shows up, cuts open the wolf, and then shoves him full of rocks and throws him in the river.
Yeah, that, and I did read that one, the woodcutter, and in that one the woodcutter shows up and cuts them out of the wolf, then they fill the wolf with rocks and everybody is fine. But then there was even an addition, and this is actually kind of interesting related to what we were talking about, but there's an addition to that story afterward where then another wolf comes and Grandma and Red actually take care of that one on their own.
So now let's talk about what I think might be one of the most famous fairy tales in Western society, at least, which is Cinderella. Cinderella is an interesting fairy tale to examine because its earliest known origin is known.
Oh?
And because it's such an enduring classic. Modern audiences can thank Walt Disney for its extreme popularity. The story of Rhodopis is believed to be the first instance of this classic tale, which has been traced back to the 6th century BCE. It was written down somewhere between 7 BCE and 24 AD by Strabo, who's a Greek geographer. The story goes, and this is quoting Strabo, "They tell the fabulous story that when she was bathing, an eagle snatched one of her sandals from her maid and carried it to Memphis. And while the king was administering justice in the open air, the eagle, when it arrived above his head, flung the sandal onto his lap. And the king, stirred both by the beautiful shape of the sandal and the strangeness of the occurrence, sent men in all directions into the country in quest of the woman who wore the sandal. And when she was found in the city of Naucratis, she was brought up to Memphis. She became the wife of the king." The first European literary version of Cinderella was released in 1634 in Italy, by Giambattista Basile. However, the version that is most recognizable to modern audiences comes from our friend Charles Perrault in 1697. And of course, not to be left out, in 1812, the Brothers Grimm released their own version of this classic fairy tale. Though this story exists in folklore across regions and territories with different cultures and languages, the core of this tale remains the same. Focusing on a character who starts off in a poor socioeconomic situation, largely unimportant to society, and rises through the ranks to some level of success or wealth or importance. There are several prominent non-European versions. Yi Xian is a Chinese fairy tale first written down around 850 AD. There are, of course, many oral versions that predate this written version. The story goes that Yi Xian is the daughter of a tribe leader who passes away. She is then left in the care of her stepmother, who mistreats her. She befriends a fish who ends up being the reincarnation of her mother, who had long since passed away. Her evil stepmother and stepsisters brutally kill the fish, but Yi Xian is able to find the bones and use their magic to help her prepare for a local festival,
including a magical
golden shoe. Yes, exactly. We have reincarnation in this story. We have necromancy in this story.
Bone necromancy.
Pescromancy?
Yeah, exactly. Fish necromancy, yeah. Her evil family recognizes her at the festival, and as she is running away, she loses the shoe. The king from another sea island finds the shoe and searches for its owner. When he reaches her house, she tries it on and joins the king. Her evil family is killed by flying rocks. The pro version is much nicer than the Grimm version. In the Grimm version, the sisters cut off parts of their feet in order to fit into slippers, and by the end, they have their eyes pecked out by doves.
Yeah.
That's the part. That's the version I read.
So brutal, right? Like, that's the interesting thing is just like how even today, like writing a story like that, you would mm-hmm. it would be pretty intense.
To me, that version of the story. So first of all, I have so many thoughts on Cinderella.
Please.
But first of all, it makes so much more sense that the king or whoever found a shoe and then went looking for the owner of the shoe without knowing what the shoe owner looked like.
Yeah.
What never made sense to me was the fact that the prince spent the entire evening with this girl and then couldn't tell, other than with her shoe size, what she looked yeah. like. Never made sense to me. Mm-hmm. This other thing is like the idea that I've always thought that the commentary is kind of satirical on Cinderella for the fact that the mother and stepsisters or the stepmother and stepsisters are so bent on attaining status. They'll do anything to get what they want, including cutting parts of their feet off, which I think is probably some sort of satirical commentary. It's kind of what it reads as to me.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, this is ridiculous. Why are we so self-important in this way? So.
What, was the slipper glass, or was that only the Disney version?
Golden or glass? I can't remember, but it's not always glass.
Because, I mean, golden would make sense.
Mm-hmm. It starts off in, like, the earliest version as a sandal, and then in the Chinese version, it's a golden shoe. And I think there's probably a ton of different versions. Yeah.
I mean, that's a tough one. Oh, who can fit into this flip flop?
Well, it's also interesting that she's the only one, you know, in the whole, like, what unique foot size is she that no one else could get close?
That's weird, too.
17 and a half.
Oh, I never considered that. They keep saying it's because her feet are so small, but no, maybe they were like Shaquille O'Neal. Yeah, like... That's it.
I mean, can you blame the prince then? You know,
no, I guess I can't.
The whole time he's just staring at her one huge, huge foot.
The only other thing is I read two versions of this as well. I did one and then did a bonus episode, which was a different recording. In one, Cinderella is, while she is probably the best among many characters in terms of grace and kindness and all of those things, in both versions of the story, in one, she is sort of a victim of society, like a lot of these stories. But in another, it's very clear that she has some sort of supernatural power that she utilizes to sort of direct her path. Yeah. The other, it's Cinderella, which I can't remember if it was the Jean-Baptiste Basile. It might've been his version, but her mother dies, right? But she dies and becomes a tree in the backyard, and where Cinderella waters her and grows her into this tree. And so she ends up spending a lot of time talking to her mother, who is a tree. She also speaks a lot to birds. She speaks in rhyme. She basically does a lot of evocations and makes things happen. She creates her own dress, goes to the ball. It's essentially a witchcraft sort of setup, but she's given kind of some sort of agency over the story instead of it just happening to her. So she's a better protagonist, in my opinion.
Yeah, I like that a lot more.
I did too. I said the same thing. It's just a cooler story.
And it's a little hard to be able to identify with someone that's just basically nothing special about them except that their life sucks.
The story of Cinderella and the story of Sleeping Beauty, it's more or less, it's named for them, but it's really a story about the people around them and not them directly.
I'm sorry, I would like to redact my statement. It's actually very easy to identify with someone who, you know, there's nothing special about them except their life sucks.
But, oh, boy.
It is, however, not the type of escapism that makes for a good story.
Agreed.
Yeah, for sure. It's also interesting when we talk about common themes that we see, right? Parents passing away, especially mothers, and the idea of those mothers then being, you know, like in the one of the versions I just referenced, the mother was the dead fish, right? She was reincarnated into a fish. In this version, she's a tree.
The one with the skelemancy.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, that the Chinese version and a European version have like kind of the same core, but like different skins kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
So we're going to put a pin in this fascinating conversation with John Cook for this week, and we're going to come back next week with part two of The Disturbing History of Fairy Tales. So thank you guys so much for being here, John. It's been an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you aren't already subscribed to Fido, please do that on any podcast platform. And John, where can people find you on social media?
You can find me. I'm on Facebook and Instagram at Fideau Podcast. And you can also go to FideauPodcast.com, and that'll direct you to the show or to my merchandise or anything that you'd like to find out about Fideau. And also, if you are interested in becoming a backer, you can join the Patreon at patreon.com/FideauPodcast and become a member of the Rule of Three. I'll send you a personal letter. It'll be really cool. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, perfect. So yeah, come back next week and we'll have more disturbing details for you then. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Is there anything else you want to add?
No.
All right.
That was perfect.
Okay.
Now, if you're enjoying Fideau, then you should definitely subscribe on your podcast platform of choice so you don't miss an episode. You can also go to FideauPodcast.com and listen on any device. Make sure and share Fideau with your friends and family if you like what you're hearing. Word of mouth is my best advertisement. Don't forget to leave me a comment or a question, and I might be able to read them on the air. I love hearing from my listeners. Don't miss the new store as well. T-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, and even a Fideau pint glass can all be yours. Look for the link on my website. You also don't want to miss out on the exclusive new Fedork fan T-shirt. You'll have to message me to order one because they're not available on any website. So, if you're a true Fedork, let me know. You can follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Fideau Podcast, and if you would like to support the show more directly, you can become a patron. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/FideauPodcast. There is behind-the-scenes content, early access to upcoming episodes, merchandise discounts, and if you join, you'll get a personal handwritten thank you from me in the mail, as well as a Fideau sticker. Also, you'll get a mention here on the show. That brings us to the end of Season 2, Episode 26. Watch for the next episode of Fideau coming soon. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you once upon a next time. Fideau is a member of the Pizza Rice Podcasting Collaborative. Check us out at pizzaricepodcast.com.